The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast is supported by the Defending Our Neighbors Fund. Across the country, immigrants are facing family separation, wrongful detention, and deportation without due process or access to legal support. In 2024 alone, there were more than 2.5 million immigration court cases without legal representation. That means millions of people were denied the most basic protection we expect from our justice system, the right to a fair process. Powered by people like you, the Defending Our Neighbors Fund is providing access to life-saving legal aid to families in crisis, but they urgently need your help to meet unprecedented demand. The government is pouring billions of taxpayer dollars into enforcement while slashing funding for legal aid. That makes your support more urgent than ever. Help defend your neighbors and keep families together. Donate now at defendingourneighbors.org/fund. Hey, this is Dre, and we're going to pause here with the people. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to talk about all the news that you didn't hear with regard to race, justice, and equity. And if you or someone you know has been impacted by the federal government shutdown, we're sending love and solidarity. We've added links in the episode description to help you find food aid and community support near you. Let's continue to love and support each other. Here we go. History is written by the victors, as they say, then traditional news media isn't doing much better. We see the headlines, we hear from the nation's most powerful leaders, and watch pundits analyze it all in studios far removed from the everyday people caught in the crosshairs. Not anymore. Alex Wagner wants to step away from the traditional media bubble and towards the folks most affected by our unprecedented times in her new show, Runaway Country with Alex Wagner. She'll bring you stories from the front lines and the voices of those too often left out of the conversation. You can listen to the trailer now. Make sure to tune in to the premiere of Runaway Country with Alex Wagner on October 23rd. New episodes drop every Thursday. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and watch on YouTube. Well, a lot really does happen in a week, which I've said every week, but it really does. I'm like, this is sort of wild. This is DeRay at DeRay Watt on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn at Bossier Shay on Instagram or at Bossier S on Spill.
Bossier Shay. Bossier is a dope. It's just a dope name.
Never changing it. Never
changing it. Bossier. It's like she the boss. I'm sure you had that your whole life, but you know, I'm the original.
I would just put Esquire in front of it, just lying.
Not in front of it, behind it, right?
You know who's not an Esquire.
I'm like, did I miss something? I'm like, I think the letters go.
Bossier Esquire, yeah.
There you go.
In one of the more interesting pieces of news across the lakes, rivers, and oceans was the people who stole from the Louvre. This has nothing to do about race and justice or equity, but I was really interested at the theft that happened in the middle of the morning. I was like, oh, and they climbed straight out the window. They got these people in HD, 4K. And that wasn't even the only jewelry that was stolen that day. They stole from other French places. They just went on a jewelry heist. And I was fascinated by that.
Me too. And you know what? Since we don't know who they are, this might be a story about race and justice and equity. These might be people coming back for their ancestors' things, and I'm not mad at that. I do find it interesting that most of the world has reacted in like one of two ways, right? Like, I live in Los Angeles, so everybody is like, you know, this is going to make a great screenplay, right? Like, can't wait to write that. And then the other way is like, well, you lose it how you got it. You know what I mean? Like, you pillaged and stole it, so karma, baby.
And shout out to the way the space has like gotten just smarter about stuff over the years. Because that would not have been the response a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
But to see people be like, oh, well, they stole that stuff anyway. Is interesting.
One thing that I wanted to like map onto this moment was the fact that Ocean's 11 came out in 2001 during the recession. So I do think in an interesting way, like there does seem to be this kind of pattern, even though I guess you can't orchestrate this type of heist. One was like obviously directed and produced and the other one is real. But it does seem that when we're in these kind of economic pressures, we get a lot of catharsis from seeing these moments of justice happen. I think that a lot of people internalize it as. And then also, there to me is a lot of connectivity between this and Luigi. Like, I think that we're just in an era of people desiring and loving to see whatever they feel is social justice. And it's interesting because I feel like Hollywood is not enough anymore. So before it could be directed and scripted and acted. But now that we're in the post-reality show era, in the post-social media era, people want the real thing. We don't just want to see it in the beginning scenes of Pose. We want somebody to really be in pain for it. And, you know, that's the Louvre in this case.
Yeah.
That's the Louvre. There's a lot of grifting going on, it seems, because the FBI is cracking down on the NBA. Ooh. When I saw the coach who had the X-ray glasses for the cards, did y'all see the video of the X-ray glasses?
I did not see the video.
I didn't see the video of the X-ray glasses.
Oh, so when you put the glasses on, it just shows in like infrared, it shows like what the card, like it just has like a big K in the middle of the card that you can only see with the glasses. And he, you know, they alleged that they were actually working with the mafia. It was some mafia component as a part of that. So that's like a coach and some players. And then the second part of the NBA scandal was the betting, the gambling, like the fixing the games because they had bet money. Now, what is annoying about this administration is that they have jumbled all of it together because they just don't like the NBA because the NBA has this far not embraced Trump in the way that the NFL has.
Right.
There was Chauncey Billups and Terry Rozier on the poker side and then a whole slew of other guys on the betting, gambling side. And it is an interesting thing where at least, you know, when the FBI had press conferences, you sort of were like, okay, like, I mean, obviously we're skeptical of the police, but you weren't like, oh, they just made everything up.
Right.
Whereas this, you really don't know anymore. You're like, this could be all literally 100% made up. Or it could be real. You don't really know what is up anymore, which is an interesting thing to be in.
Yeah, I have to be honest. These kind of old school, like, American themes. Like, I am a huge, like, I love film. I'm scared to say this, but it's the truth. One of my favorite films is Pulp Fiction. And part of what makes Pulp Fiction great is this kind of combining of these almost stereotypical American film themes. So you have a heist film inside of that kind of boxing ring where Bruce Willis was, there was a fixed game and like this kind of like noir mystery, like all these kind of different American film, novel, stereotypes are just in one film, but totally reimagined. And now it's just back. Like, we're talking about, like, the mafia. We're talking about gambling. We're talking about all these different things. And it feels a little odd in a way that I'm still trying to figure out words to articulate because it feels we're in a pattern. Like, things that we've always interacted with are coming back in a more absurdist fashion, but in almost a calculated absurdist fashion.
Yeah, I mean, first I was like, what else has the mob been doing? You know, because I think we've been talking about the mafia as if it like doesn't exist
what
anymore.
What a great question, by the way.
Elected. I'm like, what else they've been doing?
What's the mob been up to? They put an out of office message up. Taraji, you're hilarious.
And then the other thing is, you know, I think this is also what happens when people have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. You know what I mean? Like, y'all got too much money over there. Let me, a nonprofit executive, help you figure out how to better alleviate your tax burden and help you support social justice issues because y'all don't need to be doing this and winding up on the news and in jail.
You just answered your own question. They doing it so your nonprofit ass doesn't become more, get more profitable.
But you know, Chauncey Billups is a player and a coach that a lot of people have a tremendous amount of respect for. And so I think, also when I was a baby gay, all the girls I dated liked basketball, and he was like at his peak then. So I spent a lot of time watching Chauncey Billups play basketball. And I just wonder what this is going to do to people's like belief in the integrity of the sport and the game. Because people already think like who's going to win this season is predetermined, that this is basically like one choreographed kind of drama or soap opera for sports fans that makes billionaires even richer. And I think this is going to further undermine people's confidence in the game and love and respect for it.
Shauna, I think I would have believed that more pre-Trump, but I think that I think that there's a moment where you could literally be like, I'm just being targeted. Like even the press conference, they're like, getting the words wrong, you know, you're just
fair.
It all feels so amateur all of a sudden. Fair. You're like, before, this would have been like, career's over, everything's a wrap, da-da-da. But in this moment, you're like, you know, they're going after Tish James with a woman who has never practiced
qualified.
Law before.
Yeah.
You're like, this is really bizarre. So, I don't know. And then in the bizarre world of fools, we get our dear friend Eric Adams, who said all that stuff about Cuomo, talked cash money slick about Andrew Cuomo, and came out and endorsed him. Mm-hmm. Now, I was just having this conversation with somebody. I thought Cuomo must have been smart. Like, he'd been governor forever. He's been in politics. He's running for mayor, and I hear him talk for the first time. Like, I realize I've never really heard him talk, right? Like, I've seen him at press conferences during COVID, and, you know, he'd been governor forever, and he ruled with an iron fist. I'm like, well, he must. They've been propping that man up. He ain't, no lights are on. He ain't got it. They've been propping him up. But it is really interesting to see how afraid of Zohran they are. And what I love about Zohran is that Zohran can be, he is so composed in his delivery and the words are freaking them all out. And I love it. It is like such a beautiful, I'm proud of him as a Bowdoin alum. And I'm just like, I love that you are like stressing these people all the way out and right. And like, it's the right message. Your heart's in a good place. But Eric Adams, what a continued scammer. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Lean. Doctors call it weight cycling. Half of Americans do it. And if you do it enough, you're at risk of diabetes, liver damage, heart attack, and stroke. Weight cycling is when you lose 10 or so pounds, but then you put the pounds back, plus a couple more. That puts tremendous strain on your organs and leads to serious health issues. Bottom line, most people need help to stop weight cycling, and here's a great way. Non-prescription Lean was created by doctors. Lean is an oral supplement, not a GLP injectable, and the science is impressive. Its studied ingredients also target weight loss in three powerful ways. Lean helps maintain healthy blood sugar. It helps control appetite and cravings. And it helps burn fat by converting it to energy. And burning fat helps keep the weight off. If you want to lose meaningful weight at a healthy pace and keep it off, add Lean to your diet and exercise lifestyle. Get 20% off when you enter people at takelean.com. That's code people at takelean.com.
I have so many things to say. First, I'm excited for Eric Adams to be out of office because he's one of my favorite scammers to just sort of like follow and laugh at and quote. But secondly, you know, in thinking about who's lining up to endorse Cuomo over Mamdani is, you know, a former White House speechwriter and a Washington Post columnist, right, took to the opinion pages of the Post to skewer Mamdani and say that everyone should vote for Cuomo. And I clicked on the article and read it because the headline was, "Hold Your Noses, New Yorkers, Here's the Best Choice for Mayor." And I was like, for sure, this is going to be like I'm no radical, but Mamdani is like the person you should vote for. And it was the exact opposite. He starts with talking about when David Duke, head of the Klan, ran for governor in Louisiana and how terrible that was. And then he goes on to say, I actually feel like I should read part of this, right? He says, let's be clear, Cuomo does not belong in Gracie Mansion. He left the governor's office in disgrace after a state investigation found he sexually harassed 11 women and then carried out a campaign to exact retribution against one of his accusers. During the COVID pandemic, he forced more than 9,000 COVID-positive patients back into nursing homes and then tried to cover up the number of deaths that resulted. He was facing impeachment by the Democratic-controlled New York State Senate when he resigned. Now he's trying to make an improbable comeback. New Yorkers should hold their noses and pull the lever for him anyway. And that is just wild to me.
What? Crazy.
That was from the New Yorker?
From the Washington Post.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. The opinion section, I'm assuming.
Yes, but this person is a columnist and a former White House speechwriter, right? So this is a person who, like, if you are in the political know and you're looking for guidance and advice, they wrote this and they ran it.
I hear that, but also I think because of that last firing of Karen Atia, I think that, like, delegitimized the Washington Post so much, at least to me. And I think that that was such a public thing, and I think that it was such a decision that it feel to me there's certain places that just don't even feel trustworthy anymore because of the actions that they made. Whereas if the New Yorker ran it, I would have been like, oh. And then I get the New Yorker, I was like, I ain't run across that article. But it's so ridiculous. I think what I liked about the moment of Eric Adams endorsing Cuomo was it showed the game of politics that they've all been playing for so long. And I think that now Zohran genuinely doesn't like y'all. Zohran genuinely doesn't see it for any of y'all and is saying things that will not get him invited to any Upper East Side dinner parties. And y'all are not used to that. But y'all are used to saying a whole bunch of stuff that you don't believe and then shaking hands and sexually harassing women afterwards in the same bar. That's what y'all used to. Mm-hmm. But now Zohran's like, oh, I don't like y'all on camera or at Indochine or anywhere else. Like, I think that is a huge part of the response Zohran is getting too, is you kind of can feel the genuine disdain.
Yeah.
which we've missed as people.
Well, as we go into the guy who will not be named, but we must name, Donald Trump. I don't know if you saw Steve Bannon did that interview where he was 10 toes down and he was like, Trump will serve a third term.
Yes.
He is a divine prophet. He's doing a third term.
He's going to get a third term. So Trump 28, Trump is going to be president in 28. And people just ought to get accommodated with that.
So what about the 22nd Amendment?
There's many different alternatives. At the appropriate time, we'll lay out what the plan is. But there's a plan, and President Trump will be the president in 28.
You know, we all got gaslit on the far left, even though, you know, there's a lot of protesters who are like, think I'm in the middle. But those of us who are like, take this man seriously, take all of them serious. When they put these Project 2025, I remember hopping on a call about Project 2025, and people were like, DeRay, it's just a scare tactic, da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. Take these people seriously. So I take Bannon seriously. The reporter's like, what about the Constitution? And Bannon literally is like, don't worry about it. We got a set of avenues that we can make this possible. More information is coming soon. He says it 10 toes down. Take these people seriously. So I wanted to bring it here to see what you all had to say about the third term of Trump and Bannon's, the certainty with which Bannon said it.
I mean, they released Trump 2028 hats and swag when they released Trump 2020. Four hats and swag. Like, I think they've always been signaling it. I agree with you, DeRay. We should take these people very seriously. They mean it. You know, we've talked on the pod before about the possibility of us never having another free and fair election in the U.S. again. This country in the next 2 or 3 years is going to feel so unstable that I think that they are hopeful that people will embrace the devil they know in Trump. And, you know, that's how FDR ended up with a third term before we amended the Constitution, right? Was because it was the height of the Great Depression. There was, you know, there was World War II and people were just like, he is doing his best. We are moving in the right direction as a country. And like, we don't want to swap horses midstream. And so I think we might see more like people, more citizens say it's not ideal, but it's the right thing so that we don't have further uncertainty and we don't experience further destabilization. Or the court will have some weird, interpretation of our Constitution that will read two terms as two consecutive terms, you know?
Yes. I think that's more likely than people choosing this man again.
I don't know. I think we have a lot of evidence that people are comfortable with him and what he's doing.
Oh, no.
Wait, is the disagreement happening because you don't think there are people who would vote for Trump for a third term?
I think people will. I think people will say, it's not ideal. We know him. We're in the middle of a lot. Everything feels uncertain. Let's choose the guy we know.
But are you saying that you don't think that people will do that, DeRay? Or are you saying that you think the courts will block that from being a possibility?
I think the last poll that I saw is that he is more unpopular than he's ever been, which is why they're doing all this stuff around gerrymandering, ending mail-in ballots, because he is trying to figure out how to get the numbers back if they can pull off a third thing. So I think that they might be able to do it mathematically, just which is why they're like re-engineering the voting map. But I think that the impact of him has been so crazy that some of the groups that supported him last time, like I think the only people supporting him now, hardcore, are like the very avowed white supremacists, but I don't think he's getting the Hispanic vote like he got last time. I think there'll be a set of people that he got last time that I don't think he's going to get again. I'm happy to be wrong, but I don't think that's why I think they're overdoing it or like doing it as much as they need to just change the voting options, because I don't think he has the numbers if the map stays the same.
Got it. I think I was so, again, sometimes I will watch stuff kind of like symbolically before I kind of digest it like politically or intellectually. And it was so interesting hearing Steve Bannon, who is born from Virginia with his Southern accent, talk to this British reporter. And it was like, just here listening to the voices interact with each other. It's like, here is like the son of colonization talking to like the grandmother of colonization, just like with the voices and her being so like you kind of could tell like she was a little bit shocked. She was trying to like kind of keep her composure. But it's almost like there's this kind of like weird out of control son that old school colonization has birthed, and now you're trying to like kind of put the toothpaste back in the tooth tube, and it was just like interesting to hear like this kind of hear those dynamics to me, specifically when I think about where accents come from and how Southern accents derive from British accents, blah 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 blah. I think anything is possible. Again, I love my knitting coat lady. And I think that one thing about when people are under the blanket of cult influence is anything's possible. So it doesn't matter if we're talking about the rapture or we're talking about a third term. people are believing it. So it would just be too ignorant for me to really try to predict what's going to happen. But I'm fascinated about what, like, if this could happen, because it will show how weak a lot of the norms that we think were keeping us together are. But I am prepared. So 2028 for me is when he said that, I was like, oh, well, that's my deadline to get out. You know, and it's scary, but I do think that is definitely a possibility.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Calm. Now, it's a lot going on. Let me tell you. It's a lot going on. I feel like every day I need new strategies to help make sense of the world that I'm in. And the cool thing is that you don't need to do it alone. This is why I love Calm, because it is a tool that helps me release stress, find space to breathe, even on the busiest days. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation. And it helps me just like literally calm down. But also like there's just so much going on. Sometimes I need to reset. If you're feeling like you can use some support in navigating life's ups and downs, get the relief you need with Calm sessions. Things like guided meditations to help you work through anxiety and stress, sleep stories, sleep meditations, and calming music to help you drift off to restful sleep quickly and naturally, grounding exercises to help you reset and relax,
and expert-led talks to help you handle grief, improve self-esteem, improve relationships, and more. The Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket, so stress and anxiety relief is always within reach. Calm has over 2 million five-star reviews and can help you stress less, sleep more, and live mindfully. Calm your mind, change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/PSTP. This is an amazing value. Go to calm.com/PSTP for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. calm.com/PSTP and tell Calm you heard about them from me.
Well, speaking of our government and how it is operating or not, as you all know, we are in the midst of a government shutdown, which is impacting many things across the country. But one of the impacts has been that states are starting to signal that come November, they will be unable to continue to provide SNAP benefits to their constituents, to their residents. And so officials from several states and agencies have said that a large swath of people will lose their benefits from SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's completely funded by the federal government. So New Jersey, Texas, Illinois, Oklahoma, California, Pennsylvania, New York, Missouri, and Minnesota have issued warnings. And then Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, and Illinois have said directly that benefits will not be paid in November. We had on this pod a long conversation about SNAP a few episodes ago, and Miles asked both me and DeRay sort of what we thought the average SNAP benefit was, and we were both wrong. So just so that you all know, right, the average SNAP benefit in a fiscal year is about $332 a month per household, or $177 per person. That is less than $6 in food assistance per day. And I just want to sort of bring that to the pod, one, so that people know that this is happening, that it's on people's radar, that we are thinking about how we engage in mutual aid and support our neighbors. And also, again, because y'all know, I think in rap lyrics, the first thing that came to me is that Freeway verse on What We Do, where he says, if my sneaks start leaning and the heat stop working, then my heat start working, I'm going to rob me a person. And I just think about what happens when people are... I just think about like what happens when people are this desperate and the little bit of safety net we have is continuing to erode. So yeah, wanted to bring it to the pod.
Michael Eric Dyson, you've been stormed by Sharon. Sharonda the boss.
And Aaron Melber, who also makes a lot of hip-hop references.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So let me zoom out with food stamps. Remember that food stamps are an entitlement program. So if you qualify, you get money for them. That is different than what people call welfare, which is a Black grant. If you qualify and the money runs out, you don't get any more. But food stamps is a entitlement program, and 100% of what people get in their food stamps cards comes from the federal government. The cost of giving out food stamps, so like the paperwork, all that stuff, that's what your states pay for. So there'll be no money. There's no budget, so there will be no money. I am really impressed with the collective wisdom of Black people in this moment to not give Trump easy wins. Like, it feels like he's goading Black people to come into the street. The pretext for martial law, like da 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 da. So when I see the No Kings thing, and it's just no Black people out there, like I didn't see any Black people really. You know, we all know that if Black people had gone outside, that would be a pretext for the police to be crazy. But it's all these white people outside all of a sudden, and they're not gonna tear gas and beat up hordes of only white people. Like, that doesn't serve his purpose. So, you know, I think the food stamp thing will be wild. I was just talking to my barber today about this. I am surprised that more people aren't sort of angry at Trump for stuff, but this will reach a lot more people. So I'm interested in this. The healthcare stuff, you know, people are about to get kicked off Obamacare, and they, you know, I'm just confused why people aren't mad about that. But
it's going to be interesting. This one, I hate to use the word excite me, but mutual aid, anything you can do to help people who are in your community who might be hurting, please do those things before I say what I'm about to say. But I'm also a little bit excited about the reaction to it, for lack of better words, because to DeRay's point, we haven't necessarily got anything that has actually affected the same people who voted him in. And I feel like this is one of those moments where, of course, there are going to be Black folks harmed, and there's going to be people who had nothing to do with his presidency harmed. But there's going to be a lot of people who are affected who are all wrapped up in Trump. And I saw somebody tweet, I wish I remembered their Twitter handle, but they said, we're going to see if racists in America despise hunger or love white supremacy more. Like, we're gonna begin to see certain things cracking. And I do think it takes this, to DeRay's point around Obamacare, which I think is awful. I think Obama's a failure. I do not understand why Democrats, people on the left, even cling to it. I think it just has not done well, and I think it should be relinquished. But I think so many people had already made the decisions that this kind of crackdown is gonna make them make. If that makes sense. So so many people had already decided I can't afford health insurance, so it doesn't affect them. These were decisions that people made while Biden was in office. And I think something like SNAP, something like food stamps, is something that can really affect the daily lives of the people who are no insurance getting their food stamps, you know what I mean? And watching Fox News, like I think this might disrupt their daily racist lives. And not to say there's going to be a huge miracle that happens, but I am curious as to what the response is going to be. And I think that's probably the Democrats' game plan. Again, I think the Democrats are like, we're not going to move more left. We're not going to get any more radical in what we're doing. We're just going to make the pain be more felt. So we're a clear relief to that, which we'll see if that works. I don't think it's going to work because I think most people are in a cult.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Pate the Fever is brought to you by Mosh. Now, let me tell you, it's important to be mindful about what you put in your body. I've been more mindful as I've gone to the gym, and especially as I think about protein intake, because it is hard to find things that taste good. But I'll tell you, when people say you are what you eat, they're right, and that's how I got to Mosh Bars. Mosh is the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. And Mosh Bars also actually taste great, and they come in 9 mouth-watering flavors, including the new plant-based flavors, chocolate chip cookie, hazelnut chocolate chip, and peanut chocolate chip. And the best part that makes you feel good, too, is that Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research to the women's Alzheimer's movement. Why gender-based? Because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. Mosh bars are part of my routine after the gym. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PSTP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack or the new plant-based trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on either the bestsellers trial pack or the plant-based trial pack at moshlife.com/PSTP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode. So, switching gears, let's talk about George Santos. George Santos was a scammer. Got convicted of scamming. He was in Congress. He got a sentence, and Trump just pardoned him. Big time, top tier scammer, and the scam getting out was even better than the scam going in some ways. But what I think is really interesting about Santos, and I didn't know that Santos was actually writing while incarcerated. The South Shore Press was publishing some of Santos's writings. I just want to read some of it to you because I am fascinated by it. And it is said that these writings are what compelled Trump to pardon him. They put me in the special housing unit at FCI Fairton and then treated me like I'd become invisible. On April 28th, when I was told I was being moved to the SHU, the first thing out of my mouth was simple and urgent. I need my inhaler. An inhaler is not a luxury, it is life. I kept saying it as the hours crawled by. Each officer who passed my cell offered the same hollow reply, we're on it. Words without action are cruelty dressed up as procedure. The anxiety tightened like a fist around my chest, breathing became a battle. Still, they ignored me. By the morning of August 29th, 30 hours of terror and a night I will not forget, the warden and her deputy finally came by.
I told them plainly about the inhaler and the panic I was experiencing. I'm on it, they said. 2 hours later, while I was undergoing a psychiatric evaluation, an officer who had heard my earlier pleas acted. In 20 minutes, he had the inhaler in hand. That mercy arrived too late to erase that I had been treated as if my existence, my health, and my very breath were optional. The neglect did not stop. So he goes on and on. Another really great sentence from this is, since arriving to SHU, I've been stripped of almost everything that helped me weather this chapter. Phone calls with loved ones have been cut off. Emails to family have been blocked. Visits, rare sacred windows when a person can feel human again, have been taken away twice a month and on holidays, as if punishment were protection. I sometimes feel the life leaving my body, a slow leaking of hope. I won't pretend otherwise, but I'm not finished fighting. This is more than a personal grievance. It is a warning to a system comfortable with saying the right words while ignoring the right action. I just had to read, there's more there, but I had to read it because it is so fascinating to me. There's a set of people who do not need to be incarcerated who realize this is all bad. This is just a bad, putting people in cages is a bad thing. That if you thought the consequence was separation from general society, this is the worst way to do it is the way we're doing it. Like, there's no upside. It's not a good version. It's just bad. And then, you know, I read this and I both am like, you are absolutely right. This is a dehumanizing experience. And the privilege with which you write it is like, how dare they do this to me? Not even how dare they do this to the other people, but you're like, how dare this happen to me alone?
I definitely think Eric Gardner haunted his ChatGPT prompt when he wrote that or generated that. It was interesting, so many with the inhaler and the not breathing, how that was in such close relationship with Eric Gardner. And, you know, it's just all bullshit because as soon as he comes out, he's still pro-Trump, helping the Republican Party, helping a fascist regime. He's still doing all those same things. And I just, listen, I know a stunt queen when I know a stunt queen. So I know somebody, like I can hear when somebody is using their situation to get what they want. And if none of this experience resulted in political enlightenment, I know what you were doing. So I don't want to question if this story even happened because I know prisons treat people horribly. But yeah. I do wonder the sincerity of anything that he says. And he can really go to hell. Now that, you know, like I'm not... yeah, he can go to hell.
I thought about the Chrisleys, who Trump also pardoned, right? And the father has become like a for real abolitionist, right? Has for real been like, oh, no, it's people in there who should not be in there or have been in there for way too long, given the crime they committed. And it seems like he's actually been leveraging his platform to like talk about his experience and the experiences of others in ways that seem to be moving people that might not listen to other folks, which has been interesting, right? I'm thinking about, you know, Miriam Kaba, who always says, like, you are excited when anyone joins the party, even if they come late, you know? And so if Santos is really interested in joining the abolitionist party, I want to welcome him with a degree of excitement.
I don't think nothing about, you know, what DeRay spoke said had any abolitionist. I think I think being in prison and saying they treat me bad is not abolitionist thought. That is having your eyes open.
And he clearly wasn't like, they treating us bad. Yeah. He was clear about they treating me bad.
They're treating me bad. That's where it's coming from. To me, the only time any of this is useful is when somebody sees that they're getting treated bad, then they connect it with people with less power around them are being treated bad. And then once you get out of prison, to me, what I've seen and heard people be illuminated on is that you figure out that, yes, prison is bad, but we're in our own type of societal prison once I'm out of prison, too. There are remnants of prison culture and American culture that I want to dismantle, too. That makes abolition. Getting an inhaler, not getting an inhaler makes an abolitionist not.
I'm hopeful he'll start connecting the dots, but
kill,
I hear you.
Kill the hope, get the rage.
That's a t-shirt. Kill the hope, get the rage is a t-shirt.
So first of all, y'all, I want y'all to come on this journey with me because A, I'm not feeling the best. So if you hear something in my voice, that's what it is. But also, my voice is heavy with a class analysis right now. So on this podcast, week after week, I talk about class and just kind of the fracturing that I've been seeing inside of the Black community. And my news this week, which has to do with another Black political podcast, is in a hip hop podcast, kind of illustrates that beautifully to me. And that is the Native Lamb podcast and the Joe Budden Show podcast. So essentially, Mark Lamont Hill is on the podcast, gets into an argument with Queens Flip. The Native Lamb podcast sees that content, makes their own content around it, and then inside of it says Joe Budden Show and the dumbing down of America. There's a lot of different things because we're not going to pretend that the Joe Budden podcast isn't a patriarchal force in our culture. But yeah, we also cannot just demonize things that so many Black people are finding entertainment in. And we also can't demonize singular Black people. But I'm having my own tough time sifting through how I really feel about all of this. But anywho, Joe Budden then responds on the podcast and says, you know, we picked up Mark Lamont Hill when y'all wouldn't. We were here saving him and loving him, and y'all have all this to say when he's on our podcast and talking about how he needs to come home, this proverbial kinship bullshit home that people talk about. But it's like, we're talking about come home as if him being around other Black men and Black women is not home just because they're not the Black men and Black women you deem him he should be around. So this birthed this conversation around class, conversation around the academy versus the street. It birthed this conversation around how we imagine ourselves, I guess, moving forward in the new media ecosystem too, that I thought was really interesting. Whereas, do we just not talk to people we don't agree with who are in the Black space? If we think, you know, I use the term minstrelsy, if we feel as though people are engaging in digital minstrelsy, does that mean that we do not engage with them, or we ignore them, or we try to muffle them, or do we try to interrupt those spaces? Do we try to engage those spaces, et cetera, et cetera? And I just thought the response was just so interesting in, I don't know, it was hard for me to not just kind of zoom out because I've been talking about class inside of the Black community so much. So I don't really have a side. I can totally sit with, I do want to be clear that Angela Rye has apologized since that moment, but I did just want to zoom out because I have been talking about this class fracturing, and I thought this was such an interesting tabloid moment that kind of illustrates what I've been talking about for so long. Yeah, I have not come up with any ideas. I think we're in a bad place, if I'm being honest. So it's hard for me to come up with any ideas around it because I do think the fracturing has happened so much that it's beyond repair. And even when I look at Native Land podcast and that they just got Bakari Sellers to be on the podcast, who's taking APAC money, who is a part of the kind of neoliberal movement that I accuse of being responsible for the current downfall of Black media and Black political power. I see that Native Land podcast as a type of digital minstrelsy. I see what they're doing as performing activism and Black power, but still benefiting from white supremacy or platforming people who are so dire to our cause. So I think that everybody is participating in it, you know, and and we're just kind of deciding what mask we want to wear. So that's the news. It's a little bit more gossipy. Sorry that I didn't have a clear critique on it, because I think that we're working through it, and I think there's really not a critique to be had, because I just think that's the reality that we're in right now. The reality is we're in a segregated by class Black culture, and we're seeing the results of that when we do want to do things like vote or mobilize, of how separated we are. But yeah, I want to see, did y'all hear the news? What was y'all thoughts about it? DeRay, I know that some of your favorite people in this have it mentioned in this story. So I'm so excited to hear what you think too.
I like most people on the Native Land podcast. But the person who said this, this is a run-of-the-mill for how they engage other Black people. There's like a self-righteousness about a position in society and in class that I think emboldens them to continue to make statements like this and then apologize. So like this to me seems like a pattern, not an anomaly, but that notwithstanding, I think it is interesting. I think what's true in politics, at least, is that there was a class of people, and I know them. They are, some of them are my friends, who got to speak for, represent, be the voice of, were the consultants around Black people. And they, so there's a part of Angela's comments that it makes sense to me how and why she said it, because for so long, that worked. Like that, the narrative worked, the like, you know, there's a way and a place you go to speak about Black people and a da-da-da. Like, I think that worked for a long time. I think we're in a moment where there's a real schism between, like, you know, there's a group of people who, a huge group of people who are not going to food stamps. And it's our people about to beat up people.
Yeah, yeah.
They not on a Native Land podcast. They are certainly not represented on the podcast. And I think there is something about Charlamagne and Joe's podcast, and clearly they are rich, so, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I do think that they, and you can criticize Charlamagne and Joe, frankly, endlessly. There are a lot of things you could say about them. But what they do have is their pulse on the everyday. They got that down. They understand like what people are talking about and what the issues are that people are talking about. Not what MSNBC is talking about, but what like aunts and uncles are talking about. And I am always convinced in organizing, whoever gets aunts and uncles will always win. So Angela's comment was interesting to me because she's sort of like, lead aunts and uncles and come to the rich people. You're like, that is just that's an interesting thing to do in a moment where like the infrastructure around is falling apart. And the last thing I'll say, I've talked about the jail a lot. I think about the number of people I know who have a lot of political power who just have not been in a room with people who don't make $100,000 a year. Like who, you know, like who like earnestly are in community with people who do not share their economic reality. It's real dicey out here. And they start to believe a set of things about the world that are really like, that's your Black boo. That is not what the world is sort of not experiencing things like this. And I think that that comment just exemplifies it, hence the apology.
It's a lot to unpack. And like, I feel really conflicted by a lot of it, to be honest, because I think in this moment where Black women are experiencing disproportionately negative impacts around employment, et cetera, right? We talk about SNAP benefits, right? We're talking, and when we talk about Black people who, you're also talking about Black mothers, you know what I mean? And so there's also like, how do you critique someone while also acknowledging their positionality and also acknowledging that sometimes they have leveraged that positionality as a shield, you know, against critique, which I think is all kind of messy right now, especially when Joe Budden is in the conversation and my God, is that man a misogynist? You know what I mean? And so you're like, man, you don't be out here making me side with Joe Budden, girl. It's so many complicated and conflicting feelings around that. I also just want to note, like, we're also having this conversation on a podcast, you know what I mean? And having this conversation, you know, with people who have, you know, degrees from selective universities and, you know, who enjoy quite a degree of class and professional privilege ourselves. And so I also think it's important to name that. Whew. I do wonder, though, what, like, cross-class solidarity looks like. And as somebody who has acquired class privilege over the course of her own career, like I didn't inherit it, I often find myself in rooms with other Black people who inherited class privilege who feel totally disconnected from me and my lived experience, right? Like I still have a brother who hits me up and is like, can you send me $25 on Cash App? You know what I mean? Like I'm at the store right now. And that's a fundamentally different experience and like proximity to people who are, to your point.
Don't be telling your brother's business.
He ain't gonna listen to this podcast. He ain't gonna know I told y'all. But you know, like I, and y'all don't know which one. Y'all know I got five of them. So
right.
I do think that there's something about like that being my reality. Like when I shared with you all, you know, I had a grandmother who passed last week. When I get off this podcast, I'm going to be back in Compton, right? With my cousins. Like this is not, we're trying to figure out who's going to pay for what for the funeral. You know what I mean? So there is something about like that always reminds me of like, I live on the West Side, sure. I have a master's degree, sure. I earn six figures, sure, right? But the moment we log off from this recording session, I'm going to be with a whole group of people who don't. And right. They remind me all of the time that like some of what I care about, some of what I'm talking about, and most often it's how I'm talking about it, just doesn't resonate with them. You know what I mean? And so trying to figure that out, even like this Prop 50 stuff that we were talking about a little bit earlier, you know what I mean? Like my cousins are like, what box do I check? And like, that's it. And they gonna check whatever box I tell them, but that's it. And, you know, I have a cousin who's got three kids who was like, that's what he's focused on right now, right? Is feeding his three kids. So yeah.
Something that both of y'all made me think about, specifically with your honesty around Joe Budden, is like being 100% honest around also why the fracturing is happening specifically in the media space, right? So a lot of people, well, I'm thinking about women and queer people in the side of the Black community, have fractured off from talking to Joe Budden's podcast because we have found those to be dangerous spaces. Mm-hmm. We have found those to be spaces I couldn't even imagine me or DeRay on Joe Budden's podcast, because mm-hmm. I think that it has declared itself without declaring itself a homophobic space.
Mm-hmm. Joe follows me on Twitter, just to be clear.
Well, he has to, you know, so he can pretend to be.
I hope that me articulating this pushes something else besides a vanity follow.
I think I follow him too. Maybe we follow each other.
Yeah. So I think that, and this is, again, this is just like showing in like American, so like in social media in general, when we think about red pill content, even for the white boys, there has been such a separation because those environments have been hostile, you know? So it's not just around, I think part of the conversation being like class and elitism and academia, I've talked about that stuff all the time, and I try to bring those things up all the time, but also those spaces have been hostile. I'm glad to see Mona, who has been on the podcast, who has been openly pro-trans and pro-queer, and I think that's powerful, and I hope that that gives other people, even people who fit that environment more, when I think about like Sexy Lexi or T.S. Madison or something like that, like who can ride the wave of that room a little bit more. But mm-hmm. but it's not just the elitism, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's not just the class. It's also been open hostility towards Black women and Black queer folks and Black trans folks that has helped that separation happen.
Do you know the What Could Go Wrong podcast? Anyway, one of my brother's best friends also has a podcast. It's a pretty popular one. And it's a video podcast. And I get into it with him all the time. Like, we just be DMing. And I'm like, you shouldn't have said that. That was wrong. That was homophobic. That was misogynist. Like, we get into it, right? He is seriously like one of my brother's closest friends. And I think what I'm reflecting on in that moment, Miles, is like, I love that man. My relationship with Keem is not going anywhere. He feels like a brother to me. And I'm confident in pushing him in our interpersonal dynamic. But if you put a mic in front of my face, I don't know what I would say. And not because I don't stand by what I believe, but because I would be like, I don't want to be the less, which to use Charlemagne's thing, donkey of the day on the internet, where people are like, I can't believe that woman sat there and let that man say that to her in her face, right? But it's like interpersonally, no cameras, no mics. We go on toe-to-toe. And at the end of that, I'm still in relationship with him. We've been in relationship most of our lives, you know? And I do think there's also something about the external scrutiny that prevents a lot of us from engaging in spaces where we could actually move people and do the real work.
I think that's right. I like that. Yeah, the only thing I'd add is, Miles, I agree with you. And I would extend it to say that the fracturing has not only been around issues of identity, but also issues of like political reality. And so I think about a group of people that I know and have known for a long time, where their read on what the issues are, or like even things about the police. Like, I'm like, that's the wrong read. Like, I'm not listening to you anymore because I think the way you like see and think about the world is like off. You're not homophobic and misogynist, but you are barely progressive. You're like mm-hmm. sort of holding on by like a thread, right? Mm-hmm. Or you still believe in this idea that like, I actually do think you love Black people. You just don't think there's a group of them worth your time and energy. I like know Black people who believe that, who like, they're like, I love them people, but I don't want to be around them. I don't want to see them. I don't want to eat with them. I don't want, and I'm like.
No. I wasn't saying it like that. I just want to interpret like, Chris Rock made that popular, who got slaps with the, oh, there's mm-hmm. Black people and there's niggas. And I feel like we've actually adopted that ethos.
Yeah. So I think that the fracturing actually is on that line too, where I think you get there's a generation of Black people because the internet we were able to scale some version of a political consciousness in a way that I think we could not before. Like your videos and people are just smarter than they like sort of see the world better. And I think they're like, I don't want to hear you talk down on me right now.
Yeah.
I don't want to. So I'd rather listen to Joe because we grew up with misogynistic music. And like we have sort of had our own filters on misogyny and like we sort of had to take the good out of the mess for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, I don't want to be talked. You don't know what this is like. I don't want to be talked down on this. And I don't want to be. So I think that fracturing is as real as the identity fracturing.
It is not fun. You know what I mean? Like, I was just watching the documentary on Jerry Springer and how they dethroned Oprah during Jerry Springer's height and stuff like that. There is an American appetite, Black America or just America, for things that are, I don't want to call Joe Budden's podcast trashy because I don't feel that way about his podcast, but there's a certain types of talks and conversations and entertainment that does better. Like if I wasn't doing like we've had discussions offline around how can we make the podcast lighter and stuff like that. These are mm-hmm. heavier conversations to do, and it's easier to we're vegetables. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We are not Debbie cakes. And sometimes, you know, you're never gonna beat people who are serving Debbie cakes and French fries because people like that. But people are you gotta put all types of sauce for people to down their broccoli. So I think that's a part of it too.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.